Hello, everyone.
Welcome to Scholars Beyond the Tower, conversations from our fields. We're all involved in something, and our work matters.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Caroline. It's September 13th, and we're sitting down for a transatlantic episode with Dr. Catherine Parker. She received her PhD from the University of Pittsburgh in 2016, and she specialized in the history of cartography, history of the book, Pacific history, and the history of early modern empire. Her research focuses on the production and circulation of geographic knowledge of the Pacific prior to the voyages of Captain James Cook. She works as the research officer at the Barry Lawrence Ruderman Antique Maps Incorporated, where she manages an online collection of 60,000 map images. She researches and writes on the collection, as well as answers inquiries from scholars, organizes a biannual cartography conference, manages interns, and collaborates with archives and libraries around the world. Dr. Parker is also involved in the leadership of the International Society of the History of the Map, the Hakluyt Society, and the Society for Nautical Research, and teaches at the Queen Mary University of London. She likes running, popcorn, tea, and reading novels. Her favorite books are about books.
I love that. And Catherine, we see that you drink tea, and if we've learned anything from a glance at BBC programs, tea is very particular. So could you tell us how you drink your tea?
Indeed. I actually just drink my tea black, so I am a bit of a blasphemer in terms of actual English tea, which should have cream and sugar, but I've never been that way. So usually just have black tea of some flavor, just with nothing in it.
Oh, wonderful. I got really into lemon and lavender flavored tea last year. And that it was just so refreshing. I got local honey to mix in, but my boyfriend is more of an Earl Grey person.
Earl Grey's kind of my go-to, and I am in love with lavender of any sort. So I will have, I've actually had lavender Earl Grey before, and that's also delicious.
Oh, that's so lovely. Funny that you say that. It is lovely. When I went to, I guess 2 years ago now, I went out to Universal Studios to see Diagon Alley, and they had lavender Earl Grey ice cream. And I was kind of like, you know what? I'm on vacation. I want to try something new. And it was fantastic. It was my favorite ice cream ever.
Did you try the butter beer while you were there?
I loved it.
Oh, I had like two sips and I was like, this is amazing. And then the third sip, I'm like, nope, I'm done.
It was very sweet.
Yep. Indeed. I went with my brother. I was actually attending an academic conference in Orlando.
Oh, cool.
And so he lived in Fort Lauderdale. So I was like, drive up and we'll go to Universal Studios. So we ditched the last day of the conference and did that.
Hey, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, it was great. It took me years to, like, I get up the gumption to skip parts of conferences.
I always feel like I have to do everything that I'm scheduled to do. So like, if I get a conference program, I have to go to all of the sessions. You know, if they're concurrent, then, you know, you can only be in one place at one time.
Right.
But I feel like if I skip a session, that's, like, bad.
I felt like that for years, and then I realized literally no one goes to all the sessions.
Yes.
And that made me feel better.
I would be, like, walking through, and I would just see people, and I'd be like, oh, I recognize you, or, you know, like, I know you. Why aren't you in a session right now? And they were like, oh, no.
Yeah, taking a break. Or yeah, it's one of those things where they don't teach you about self-care when you're a baby academic. And yeah, people are like, oh no, I'm skipping this session. I'm going to go take a nap or going to go out for a drink with a friend or something like that. I'm like, oh, you can do that? Like, what?
Yeah, just, or like some people would just not go to sessions. They were like, yeah, none of this interests me. You know, none of this is in my wheelhouse or in the area that I'm interested in. I don't know any of these people, you know, from grad school or other things. There's really no reason for me to be in this room. So instead, I'm going to go get food that's not from the conference.
Indeed. Yeah, no stale cookies or whatever they had at the...
Oh my goodness.
I've also been to a conference where they didn't buy cookies, and then literally the European academics staged a revolt and demanded the conference organizers get more biscuits. It was quite excellent.
I was at a math conference in Baltimore, and it's like the way that the math people do their conferences is every couple of years they have what they call the joint mathematics meeting, and it is like tens of thousands of people just descend on a city. But whoever was on the advanced team at the hotel, the convention center, or what have you, didn't tell any of the local restaurants.
Oh no.
So it was, oh, I felt so bad. Because there was no food at the conference. It wasn't like where they feed you. It was like, you know, like you're an adult, go find food. Like you,
right.
Not here, you can get somewhere else to get food. And it was just, it like we would call to just like pick up food because we knew that we wouldn't be able to get a table anywhere. So we would call and we would say, hey, you know, and eventually someone said, like, look, what's going on? Like, why is it so busy in the middle of
with all these mathy people?
And I was like, oh, okay. So all of the math people decided that they really like Baltimore. So
yeah. They're here. At once.
For no other reason.
Yep.
You had to break the news.
Yes. Because someone just asked me. They were like, why are there so many people here? They did tell the aquarium, so we got discounted admission to the aquarium.
Solid.
Yeah, which was really nice. But like no one else in that like inner harbor area knew about this conference. Yikes. I was like, that is so rude.
That is poor advance planning. As someone who's planned a few conferences at this point, like, oh, come on.
Like especially like where the, imagine if like the AHA and the OAH met together.
Yeah, we're all at the same time. Exactly.
Like that's just, like you have to tell someone that you're coming.
With that many, for sure. True story, I never actually did an AHA.
I've never been to the AHA or the OAH. I actually just got the email that the deadline is coming up for the labor history conference that I usually go to or that I've been to. And I'm like, no.
Yeah, maybe not. No, I've not. Definitely another thing, like they don't tell baby academics is like, you feel like you have to go to everything, even if it's like remotely on your topic. And I've become much more selective about applying to conferences and then attending conferences as I've gotten older. Because conferences are fun and all, but when you're doing, if you do like 6 or 8, you know, in like a 6 month period, it's just, it doesn't work out.
That's too many.
It is too many. And then what are you going to present? You've like run through all your research probably.
Yeah. And then you have no time to do anything else because all you're doing is writing either conference applications or conference papers, assuming you get into them.
Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I guess that takes us to kind of like our first question is what was it, you know, like, what was it like to become this map expert? What was that journey like?
Yeah, that was not intended. I don't think anyone ever starts grad school as a historian and wants to be a historian of cartography. I don't think that's ever the first the first subfield that they want to specialize in. So I've been a history person always, I guess. And so when I began my undergrad, I declared my history major right away and never questioned it at all. But I had always also done international studies. I went to an international high school program that had the International Baccalaureate. So I was always interested in more transnational or world history topics.
Mm-hmm.
And that led me then to apply to the kind of graduate programs I did that all had a transnational focus, and was very lucky to get in and have a funding package offered for one. And not only a funding package, but one that you could almost sort of live off of with the stipend if you were very careful and bought no things. And so that program also had a transnational component as part of our curriculum. And so I went in wanting to focus on exploration in the 18th century, specifically actually about race and how the Pacific and the Pacific peoples were perceived by European explorers. And that very quickly for me shifted from race to space as a concept to look at, because actually there's a lot of really good scholarship on race in the Pacific, so I love reading it. There's really, really good scholarship, and I wasn't sure I could do better.
And you know, as you're describing this project that you've done, I'm like, this sounds really familiar. This sounds so familiar. And it sounds like you've been, I don't know, informed or influenced by or working alongside the things that Kathleen Wilson stakes out.
Yeah, in Island Nation. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and Kathleen Wilson is great. And I have had the privilege to meet her, and that she's very intimidating, but is actually really nice in person. Once I got up the gumption to talk to her, she's a delight. Yeah, and so
my answer for a brief period of time.
Yeah, at SUNY, you're right. There was, you know, through the academic grapevine, there was a small chance at one point that she would be coming to a place where I was and that we might work together. But then as all those constellations, the stars did not align that way. But yeah, she's really fun. So definitely Kathleen Wilson was one of the things I read in my undergrad that led me to pitch this project that was looking at conceptions of race by the Spanish, the French, and the British prior to James Cook, because James Cook is such a big thing in Pacific studies. And I wanted to look at what things were like before, because we look at everything kind of through James Cook tinted glasses. And I wanted to know what the Pacific was before him, because obviously before him, they didn't have any conception of what he was like. And yet a lot of the research looks at the time before Cook with Cook in mind, and we're kind of trying to lead up to him. So I wanted to not do that. And that quickly led me to become more interested actually in not so much the peoples of the Pacific, because ironically, a lot of the European ships that go through the Pacific prior to the 1760s, they don't actually find that many inhabited islands for a variety of reasons, but they're not that good at finding people actually. And so I became more interested as I read through a lot of the voyage accounts and the manuscript sources that they're very evocative descriptions of place, and of especially Tierra del Fuego, and the Pacific they were describing was a very different Pacific than the one you are led to believe if you read a lot about James Cook and those expeditions that are a bit later. And so in looking at space and place, I began to realize that my main source bank was going to be maps, which was intimidating because you think you know what a map is until you start to really look at them, and then you realize there's this whole extra language that you don't understand. So in my second year, I realized that maps were going to have to be a huge part of my analysis, and then began the process of slowly teaching myself how to read maps and understand them as historical objects, which is something I am still working on. They are tricky, but really rewarding if you can learn to just kind of identify some of the basic parts of it. And I really am an evangelist for maps in that I think most historical projects could be enriched by looking at some sort of map or geographical object for part of the source bank. And a lot of historians don't seem to do that, and I would like that to change.
I feel like right now we're in a moment because things are shifting to so much online because of the pandemic and because of a lot of other things. I think graduate committees and graduate schools are starting to realize that the nature of going to archives has changed fundamentally. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we're not doing the work that, you know, like our advisors or our advisors' advisors did, where you have to get the funding to go to a library or series of libraries and sit there and read all of the microfilm and all of the newspapers to write your dissertation or your book. Because now it's, you know, you zip into town, because there's no funding for this anymore. So you have to make it as zippy as possible. You zip into town. In my case, you drag your husband. You both get reader's cards at the Library of Congress.
And then you divide and conquer. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. You divide, you conquer, you set up a Dropbox.
And then you never look at those images again. Yes.
You never look at those images again until you're like, oh, wait, actually, everything's closed and I'm in, you know, dissertation writing stages. What data do I have?
Exactly. I have a lot of friends writing up right now, and I feel for them intensely because they can't just zip to the library and check that citation or go check things, which I had the luxury of doing when I wrote up. And also I have the luxury of living in London, so I have access to a lot of the main archives that ended up being most important for my work. So I feel very much for people that don't have that archive access in terms of geography, but then also now with COVID, it's absolutely changed how historians work. And if you're in an archive part of a project, that has become immensely tricky, especially depending on the archive you're using. And shout out to all the librarians and archivists who are working on digitization, but certain libraries are farther ahead in that respect than others. And so I know a lot of my friends that do Spanish Empire have been giving each other webinars on how to use PARES, which is the Spanish National Archives and their online system. And so there's definitely a lot of teaching going on between people, not so much on how to use archives, but how to even just access digital platforms and search for books on all these different databases, because they all, of course, are different. They couldn't possibly be the same.
Yeah, it couldn't be, you know, like a universal thing.
And God forbid, no.
You're right. Like, and now I'm seeing more and more people are doing like GIS work and doing, you know, and doing like mapping projects.
That was actually, yes, that is funny. I was one of those. So in my original conception of this, that I was going to look at Pacific space and how that was conceived, as all people do when they get into maps and historical cartography, I was like, I'm going to have a GIS component in my project. And so I was going to do this whole thing where I mapped London, and I was going to point out where all the map makers were and where all the explorers lived and how they had these circuits and networks that crossed, and argue for the importance of London and its geography for understanding actually the geography of the Pacific. And that is actually an argument you can make without GIS, and that also, like, people have done very similar things. And so now that I've done a lot more work with digital humanities and with historical geography and the history of geography, I always caution graduate students when they're like, I'm going to do GIS. I'm like, wait a minute. Do you have a historical question that actually demands GIS? Because if not, it's just going to be this tacked on map thing. And if it's not going to further the analysis of what you're doing, if the visual you make isn't actually going to show some sort of analytical output, then no, you don't need to do GIS. I know it sounds sexy to do a digital humanities project. But actually, a lot of the digital humanities that gets done is not in terms like necessary. It's cool looking, but it doesn't actually further the analysis. And I think that's something that trips a lot of people up. It certainly tripped me up. And I ended up just having to give up that part of things entirely just because of training. But also it was pointed out to me that it wasn't going to prove anything that I couldn't prove with different methodological kind of steps. So it's, I hope that's something I wish everyone who said they wants to do GIS would question themselves before they teach themselves to use the software, because it's not exactly easy or fun all the time.
Yeah, I think it's become something that people in the humanities are saying that they want to know how to do, partially mm-hmm. because it's it feels STEM adjacent.
Yes.
And then that feels safer for a lot of us, you know, well, I can do GIS, so therefore maybe I'm safer.
Right.
And, you know, I'm very bitter because I don't do GIS. And I am one of those people who, when I look at like computer things or coding or backend stuff, I'm like, oh no. Mm-hmm. This is not me. Please don't. Like, I'm reviewing a book and they sent me a PDF and I'm like very, very, I've become unwound about that.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I'm a book review editor for one of the H networks for HMaps. And they said to us that we could offer our reviewers PDFs instead of books. And I was like, nope, I will offer them real books. Thank you.
It's funny. I've been doing a lot of book reviews for Global Maritime History. And mm-hmm. for me, I'm kind of like, you know, this is unpaid labor, but I get a book out of it. So I'm still engaging in my field and I'm building my bookcase. Mm-hmm. I might not be getting paid, but it works.
Exactly. No, I mean, I actually weirdly love book reviews. Mm-hmm. Just as a, I don't know, as a genre of writing, I love it. But yeah, you get the book out of it. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
And especially as a graduate student and as someone who still has that graduate student mindset of, you know, expenses, it's like the whole point of me asking to review the book was so that I didn't have to buy it.
Yeah.
And having a PDF of it is not the same.
It is not, especially because it's a watermarked PDF.
Oh yeah, no, that's totally no.
And I'm like, this is not helpful. Like it's legitimately very distracting to try to read this book with the watermark.
Yes, so, no, and reading digitally is just so hard.
Like, yeah, I might send them an email and be like, I really need a hard copy to do this.
And I think that's a legitimate thing to, if you are reviewing the book for them, you should get the book. And the publisher does not mind sparing a book for a review. So,
well, good.
In general, depending on the publisher, but mostly they don't.
It's an academic press, so it should be fine.
Yeah, no, it'll be good. No, but good. I love a book review. It is one of my favorite academic things to do.
So why do you love them so much?
I don't know. I guess it's going through 3 years of graduate courses, it is a format I got used to mm-hmm. and I can do relatively easily. And it's just, I love delving into what a book is arguing, what sources it's using, how it's making that argument, did it make it well? I think that kind of process is really helpful for anyone who is doing, that needs to do secondary literature reviews. I just think it's so helpful for my process then to go forward and use that in my own writing, in my own arguments. I feel like the books I've reviewed, I'm much more engaged with than a lot of the other books you just read very quickly and dash off a couple of notes for. And I like the books. They're usually pretty. I actually just reviewed Sailing School by Margaret Scotty, and it's the most gorgeous book. It's a wonderful book too. Her research and her writing is phenomenal, but it's also just, the book is gorgeous and it has like lush end papers and tons of illustrations, and it's just really well made as a book. So I'm very glad I get to have it on my shelf now.
Oh my goodness. That's how I felt. I reviewed Chesapeake Requiem and it was talking about, and it's talking about Tangier Island down in the Chesapeake and how, you know, the island is actually disappearing, and it's due to sea level rise, climate change, erosion, all of these interconnected factors. And the people who live there have either been moving back to the mainland, so most of the young people are gone, but they're also losing this way of life where they're going out there, they're crabbing, they're fishing, they're very intertwined with the water. And they opened this book with this scene right after one of the big hurricanes that came up the coast. And it was a journalist with a local, and they're in the boat looking at the cemetery. And it's just like graves are overturned just from the power of the storm. And they're talking like, this is a fading island, but the book itself was gorgeous. The cover, the photos in the middle, I loved it. I was so excited to be able to put it like in my red pile and then put it right into my bookcase.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. And as I specialize in history of cartography and history of the book. So really the material culture of them. Yeah. I appreciate a well-made book. They are lovely. Like I will definitely buy books that are just pretty. that is fine with me.
I do love a beautiful book, and you know, I feel like so many things are you know, outside of the author's or the scholar's control.
Oh yeah.
So when it all comes together very nicely, and you know, the whole book team creates this, like, not only just like this beautiful piece of scholarship that's, you know, relevant and useful, and it does what it says it's going to do, which is like amazing when they do exactly what they say they're going to do. But also like when the object itself is beautiful.
No, absolutely. And that seems to happen less and less in academic publishing.
Definitely. And I feel like, you know, maybe we should be paying more attention to how, you know, to how the publishing teams are, I don't know, made up or funded, because university publishing especially is just, it's not a moneymaker.
No, not at all. Yeah.
And I wish that it was less expensive to make a book. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, maybe something that more graduate students understood.
I wish also that more graduate students understood actually publishing as a job stream, because I've met with several kind of editors or junior editors at academic presses, and almost all of them are MAs and PhDs in history, art history, literature. So they've all have advanced degrees, and now they've gone into more the publishing side of things. And mm-hmm. as with anywhere, there aren't tons of jobs in that, but that is a field for someone if they are interested in editing and developing those types of skills. And I feel like it's one of the many things you're not told about when you're in graduate school in terms of things you can do with your degree.
Yes, it is very much a funnel where they say, okay, so now you are in, you know, your PhD program at the end of this. If, you know, if everything goes the way that you're hoping it will go, at the end of this, you will walk out, or, you know, you will leave with a doctorate and a job offer.
Yeah, and walk into a tenure track job, which no one does, and yet we all expect somehow.
Yes, like somehow we all just expect these tenure track jobs to, and not that we expect them to fall out of the sky and into our laps, but just that somehow, some way, and it might just be that you know, like you see what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're, you know, when we're in grad school and we're actively doing it, you know, like sometimes we see the searches happening where we see, you know, like the people that we're talking to are the people who got the jobs and have done the things and published the books. So we don't always see the people who said, yeah, okay, this is nice, but I'm going to do something else.
Exactly. And that's, I know in my graduate program, I really enjoyed the curriculum. It was very well run, but we did absolutely no job training while I was there. It's changed since I left for the better, thankfully. But yeah, did no discussion of necessarily even actually preparing for the job market. We could do practice job talks, but no kind of workshops on how to do that or discussions of what are job options coming out, particularly because I finished in 2016 and that was right when the job market went from very, very bad to like dismal. And so I would have really appreciated kind of more training or bringing in people that had alt act jobs and things like that. But it just really wasn't on the radar because I was being trained by people who had been trained by people that had these jobs. And so for them, that they wanted the thing and they did the thing, but they are kind of the unicorns in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
In that they were able to make it work and they were able to go through the marathon of the PhD, the postdocs here, there, and everywhere. And then by your third or fourth one, then maybe you get the tenure track job. With each step up, that window is getting smaller and smaller for who gets to go through it. Not to mention institutional, racial, and cultural barriers that would have been dragging some people down originally. And I feel like that wasn't talked about explicitly while I was in graduate school. And it's only afterwards that now it is being talked about, mostly by people who have finished as well. And just felt not quite prepared for A, the fact that the job market would be that bad, but B, that there are so many other options for jobs. Or in my case, I kind of made my job up and that worked out somehow. I wouldn't recommend that for everyone else, but it is things you never even imagined can happen. Not in like a fairy tale way. It takes a lot of hard work, but there are kind of other avenues that will pop up if you're open to them.
That's fascinating. So how did you do this? How did you make this job happen?
image rights. So I was finishing my PhD. I had been coming to the UK every summer. Thankfully, our program had nice funding for the Europeanists, especially to go abroad for their research, and the Latin Americanists. Those were our two main regional focuses. Foci, maybe. And so every summer I'd been coming to the UK, and then I was very lucky that I ended up having two back-to-back fellowship years. So 1 year to do research and then a Mellon fellowship to do writing of my dissertation. So I ended up just living in the UK for 2 years, which was phenomenal, just absolutely great. And I got to be close to all my archives, but also closer to France and Spain, so I could do more archival research there as well without having to fly across the Atlantic every time. Mm-hmm. So that was great. And then I also ended up meeting my husband while I was here. And so everything to me while I was finishing pointed to moving to the UK, which was all well and good, except that I wasn't trained in the UK as an academic, and it's a totally different academic culture. So I applied for postdocs here, but instead of applying pretty much everywhere, I limited myself geographically because I wanted to be with my partner. And then when I moved to the UK, it was very much kind of a leap of faith. Like, I had just finished and I hoped I would get, I had one postdoc, a little baby one, and then I was hoping to get another one, but it was kind of, let's, if you build it, they will come, sort of. I just moved here and I hoped that things would happen. Meanwhile, when I was finishing my dissertation, I had used a lot of map images from this website that had very nice map images that you could download for free. And so I then had to write to the owner of these map images to say, can I use these in my dissertation? Because we quote unquote publish within the university your dissertation. So you do have to get copyright imagery, right, provisions and things. And so he wrote back and was like, that's interesting. Will you send me your dissertation? And I said, sure, if you want it. And he ended up just reading that and then hiring me to do a couple of descriptive analytical essays for his maps, kind of to do rich content so that when he put the maps on his website to sell them, they had kind of a historical bent to them. And he'd been doing this for years anyway, but he'd never had a specialist in the history of cartography to help out. And he's very much a self-taught historian of cartography as well. Mm-hmm. And so he came to London for the London Map Fair, which is in June every year. And so we met up at a Starbucks somewhere in West London. And I just thought he wanted to put a name to the face of this person he'd been emailing. And he ended up just saying, I want to hire you full time to do kind of whatever you want. And I was, excuse me? What now? And so we worked out between the two of us kind of this position of research officer, which we very much made up that title, of which I would work about half time on my own research and publishing, just like an academic in theory is supposed to do, but never does within the university system. And then the other half of the time I would research and write and publish for his website and his collection. So I'm not actually involved directly at all in any buying and selling of maps, which is good because I'm not good at it. I'm a terrible salesperson. But I then kind of add to content, and then we have a lot of scholars who use our maps in their work. So I field all of those inquiries about permissions to use our images, or they have questions of a historical nature about the maps for their own research. So I get to field all of those questions. We have a conference that we do at Stanford University every other year. They have a wonderful center called the David Rumsey Map Center that specializes in map collections. And so we work with them. And so I just, in many ways, an academic who is seated with a private company as opposed to within a university. The only thing I was missing was teaching, which is sad because I love teaching. And so I was able to, here in London, get jobs at university just teaching as in an adjunct position, basically. So as and when they needed someone extra, I could do that. So I've kind of cobbled together a very much academic position, but entirely out of academia in the traditional sense, which was fun and kind of a very strange way it came about. And it all came about because I didn't want to stay on that traditional carousel of having to apply every 10 months for a new position and then move here, there, and everywhere until you get to the level where you might just get an assistant professor position. That once I finished the PhD, that just didn't appeal to me in the same way as it had before, in large part because I wanted to move country and be with my partner. So in some ways it's a big romance, I guess, which is strange because I'm very, and my husband is as well, a very kind of rational, straightforward person. So we wouldn't be the most romantic humans, but in many ways, that's what decided kind of how I ended up here.
I love that story.
My husband's now shaking his head at me. My husband doesn't agree.
But like, as someone who's not like one of those like romantic-y people, I get it. My partner and I, actually, we started dating in high school. And, you know, went to, like, different colleges, different graduate schools. At one point, just, like, we were very, very far apart from each other. Ended up getting married 3 weeks after I presented my prospectus.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not something I recommend, but the stress dreams were epic. Okay? So, and this was one of my stress dreams. I was, you know, like, I guess like 2 weeks before my exams and a couple of weeks before my prospectus, I had a stress dream that I was like getting married and I was like at my wedding venue in my wedding dress and I'm like walking up and all of a sudden it's my exams committee and Kathleen Olson was on that committee and they start asking me questions about E.P. Thompson.
As
one does at you know at their trainee's wedding, and yeah. I'm like, these were not the questions I was prepared to answer today.
Well, no, you thought you were going to say I do, not explain the making of the English middle class.
Like exactly, I was just like, this was not on the agenda today. This is totally, and then I would like wake up and be like, oh my goodness, what does that mean?
So yeah, the stress school is terrible for your mental health.
The stress dreams were very interesting, and looking back on them, it's quite funny. But then, you know, we continued, you know, living apart until it just made sense for us to you know, pay one rent instead of two. But people were
that like, was oh, a large God. Reason of why my husband and I moved in together.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, once
London is expensive.
Once I had no more funding at Stony Brook, because they give you 4 years, and then because mm-hmm. it's a, you know, a SUNY, there's like no money for the humanities.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So I decided to say, you know what, forget this. I'll get a job. I'll move to where my partner is. And, you know, and we'll work and we'll you know, see each other more than once every few weeks. And people were like, oh, it's so romantic. You're finally going to live together. And I'm just like, this was purely a financial decision.
But also, I guess that's like one of the sadness of working in a quote unquote passion job is that people didn't think it was at all weird that for years you and your partner lived apart, in large part because you were doing a job that like diametrically would not let you be together with your partner in a way that would make sense for anyone else in the whole world.
Yes, and then when he got a job and, you know, had to move, I was able to follow because the job that I work in now, they were like, oh, you know, your husband's working in the outside of the Boston area, you know, like just outside of the metro. We have an office in that area. There's a job open. You should apply for it. And I was like,
okie dokie.
What? I was like, do you want to facilitate this continued shared household?
Right, as opposed to getting a one-year spousal fellowship that's unpaid and then not getting a job wherever your partner is. Yeah, exactly. Like, having a job in which my humanity is very much recognized, and I don't think academia sets out to do this on purpose, but the way in which the institution does seem to run, it is all about the work, and the work is supposed to become your identity. And that's something I very much struggled with when I got out of graduate school and began even just my career, which is still academic adjacent, is having to kind of finally figure out who I am as a person that isn't just work. Mm-hmm. Because being just work for 6 years had been very damaging to my mental health, which wasn't exactly peachy keen to begin with. Mm-hmm. And then trying to struggle to reclaim parts of myself and then to really mm-hmm. define parts of myself that weren't just working and reading constantly for this thing I was working towards was really, really hard. I definitely feel like I broke the year after my PhD. And thankfully, I did have employment and it was a job I could do well enough that I could take some time also to just really just not do much in terms of research, just because I couldn't approach it. I couldn't think anymore because I was so burned out isn't even, I think, the right word. It was I was wrung out. There was nothing left. And it really has taken at this point, it's going to be 5 years in next April since I finished. It's taken that long to get back to a healthy, great work schedule in which I am balancing research and my job working primarily with the maps in kind of a healthy and sustainable way. It's just because grad school was so disorienting and so unhealthy in terms of how it encouraged us to work that it's taken a really long time for me to learn how to be better. And that's really frustrating, I think, for someone. Graduate students aren't, you know, they don't lack in skills. And so to be someone who's quite high functioning, it's been a real struggle to have to calm down and slow down and take my mental health seriously. That's been a real, real challenge that I think we should probably be more honest about than we often are.
I would definitely agree with what you said. I know for me, when I was doing my history master's, I was trying to keep as many balls in the air as I possibly could at one time. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I never quite could function at the level that I wanted to and that was expected of me. I did very well, but the toll of, you know, running from job to job to job, because I didn't have funding. I was an MA student, not a PhD right. student. So I would be carrying, you know, my bookstore job. And on top of that, be working nights at Carvel, which was basically just for tips. And then on top of that, be teaching children about archaeology at field trips on like my one day off from school.
Right.
And then I'd be running to grad classes where I was sitting next to PhD students who did receive funding. And I know they worked so hard. This is nothing against them. But then being judged against their work and mm-hmm. having professors who didn't always understand that, you know, when I leave this classroom, I don't get to go to an office. I don't have one. And right. I don't get to sit down and start reading for class tomorrow. I'm going to work, or, you know, I'm driving a half hour home to the home that I share with my parents and whatever family obligations await for me there. Mm-hmm. You know, we are people inside and outside of the classroom. And for me, the toll that that took, it took me a good year, I think, after grad school where I could finally read again for fun.
Yep. Yeah, that's like, the reading kind of white noise that you just can't focus on it. That's yes. a real thing. Yeah.
I felt like I couldn't read. I couldn't write anymore. And it mm-hmm. was disorienting. And then on top of that, I felt almost as if I was carrying guilt for taking a gap year and not going directly into a PhD program.
Absolutely.
So it was, I felt like as a person, I wasn't hitting any of the expectations that I had been taught to want to hit. Right. I think we're kind of like, you know, the mouse that knows if they press the button, they get the treat. That's
exactly
how
grad yeah.
students are wired. And, you know, it took me until last month to actually get diagnosed with ADD. And to realize that, you know, it's not that I'm not focusing hard enough or I haven't drank enough coffee. No, this is like an actual issue. Like there are ways right. we could do this, but it's not just that I'm not trying enough, you know? So it has been a very interesting journey, and I wish there was more support for grad students mentally and emotionally. And I think professors can be very good people, but I think sometimes we all lose sight of, you know, what students deal with when they leave the classroom, and that it...
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. There needs to be more support at the MA level, at the PhD level, I'm sure at the undergraduate level as well, although there mm-hmm. are often services set up within the university, I think in some ways that seem to be targeted to undergrads, and then graduate students are hesitant to take advantage of them.
Which or they're told that they can't.
Right. And when in reality, they, as students, they have the perfect right to access those things. But I really wish also with graduate level training, so much is dependent on your advisor for the amount of support you're getting or not getting and the amount of pressure that's being put on you as well. Mm-hmm. And so I definitely have had great advisors and I have had some very problematic advisors. And I wish there had been more extra advisor training opportunities and extra advisor support mechanisms within our program mm-hmm. because a lot of things had to go through the advisor and then you would get access to other things or then they could deal with something at the department level. So mm-hmm. it was kind of a bottleneck. And so I really wish that our graduate program and all of them had these kind of independent things set up about mental health and about where you can go with a problem. Because if your mentor isn't terribly helpful, sometimes that can really mean that a student's going to struggle a lot more than they would have to if they could actually just get a hold of some of the resources that are there for them. But Absolutely. Also I feel like graduate school is designed, especially graduate school in the US, not that graduate school in the UK is a picnic, that it's designed almost to either exacerbate existing mental health issues, which is what happened in my case, or in some ways to create them for other people, because they to achieve at the level people are used to achieving, they really have to adopt unhealthy habits.
I had a professor one semester who had us chart out our time. She gave us a week schedule and said, I want you all to sit here and block out the time that you spend doing everything in your day. Block out the sleep time, the homework time, the work time, whatever you're doing, because you're going to see that you have more time than you think. And I mean, she's a wonderful woman, but it had been an issue the entire semester where she had told me I was rushing through my work. I needed to take more time. So when I handed her that schedule back and her only response was, oh, you're very busy, I felt a little vindicated.
Yeah, you're like, really? Am I? Yeah. Yeah, no, it is. It's so, and that's actually why now that I have become a person again, one of the things I've really sought to do is actually seek volunteer opportunities. Mm-hmm. So when I was an undergraduate, I developed anorexia nervosa, and that was great to recover from as an undergrad. And recovery on average takes 7 years, and that's pretty much exactly what it took me to recover. And going to graduate school with a mental health disorder like that, because that's what they are, they're best friends with anxiety disorder, which I also have. Great cocktail. And so trying to recover from those things while in graduate school, of course, only kind of exacerbated, especially the anxiety. But now that I get to be a full person, and it's amazing kind of getting to get to a point where I'm not saying I'm perfect, but I do get a balance research outputs with, you know, a job and then finally getting some time to devote to volunteer activities. I volunteer with a group here called BEAT in the UK, which is the UK's eating disorder charity. And it's wonderful to get to serve as the position's called an ambassador and get to talk to training doctors and students about eating disorder awareness, but also to get to volunteer with, we have a helpline online. So you get to talk to people who are currently suffering and trying to get into recovery and be able to kind of share, like, I know this is the hardest thing you're ever going to do, but you can do it. And if I had had resources like that while I was in graduate school, I think that would have made many things much, much, much easier. But we just don't prioritize in any way our mental health or ourselves when we're in graduate school, partially because the cohort nature of it, we're constantly comparing ourselves to everyone else. And you don't want to admit that you might need a little bit of extra help or a little bit of something, which I always struggled with because much like we assume, it's funny having European friends because they have this idea of US college that's hilarious about living in dorms and how cute it is. Exactly. But I went to graduate school thinking, like, here I go. These are going to be the best friends I ever make. Like, my graduate cohort's going to, you know, we're all going to be very best friends. We're going to be studying together and it's just going to be perfect. And to be perfectly honest, I met some great people in graduate school, but I didn't meet the bosom buddies that I now consider my best friends at all, because I was so busy and so anxious and so worried all the time that I couldn't take the time to get to know people well or to really connect with anyone. And I think that's one of those things that we have this myth of graduate school being hard, sure, but it's also kind of great and you're in the trenches with your friends. But the whole point of a trench metaphor is that you're at war. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't connect at all with people like that. And that was, to me, that it makes me very sad because I had that kind of rosy idea that this was going to be the place to meet, you know, the best friends. And for me, it wasn't. For other people, it certainly was. But that just was not at all how things worked out for me. I mean, I feel like we need to alter expectations for those who choose to go into graduate school, not only in terms of the job market when they come out, but also the experience of them itself. We could be a lot more realistic about it before we encourage people to go into it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. I feel like one of the things that's at least coming out now, especially on academic Twitter, is people are really starting to question Karen Kleski and the professors in as a
yes.
as an institution.
I was reading this on Facebook this morning.
Okay, perfect. So you are up to speed with one of the academic Twitter or academic internet. I don't even know what to call
it. Oh, well, like, it's on Twitter as well. But this one, yeah, I had a friend that, like, their friend questioned her and then it blew up and she called him a misogynist.
Yes. And I feel like what we're missing in all of this, right, is that the academy and graduate school and this, like, pressure to produce all of the time. And one of the questions that, you know, we were going to ask you is, you know, do you feel this pressure to produce? And if you do, please tell us how you manage it, because we're, like, at our wits' ends here. But mm-hmm. this whole pressure cooker kind of scenario, I feel like, is still deeply predicated on the assumption that graduate students and academics are just like these unencumbered brains. And
exactly.
We don't have any other obligations outside of to study and to produce brilliant work. When that's
right.
Just,
and if we really loved it, we would just buckle down and do it.
Yes, right. Like if because it's not work. It's a calling. It's a whatever they want to do to make us feel like we should feel guilty for wanting to live well and be paid for our work, because
exactly.
We should be paid for our work to, you know, to just like quote Aaron Bartram, like historians should be paid for their work.
And that it is work, that we're not just wandering around singing Kumbaya and like reading and then magically putting that into writing our own books. I think the work of especially book writing and monograph writing and article writing is not something people outside of academia understand. And we could do a much better job about being transparent about that. But I definitely feel the pressure to produce, especially at the academic level. So this year, one of my big projects at the beginning of the year, moving into the beginning of quarantine, because the publisher is in Italy and he had already gone into quarantine. So we're just sending all these emails to each other like, how are you? And he's like, not great. And then we went into quarantine. So then he got to ask me the same questions. But it's going to be a coffee table book, you know, with lots of images and things like that. And I really struggled while I was working on that project that it's gonna be the prettiest thing I probably ever produce. But I really was finding myself poo-pooing my own work because I'm like, oh, it's just a coffee table book. When in reality, that's going to be the thing that speaks to, for example, my grandfather more than a monograph ever could in terms of what I do. And it will most likely, you know, be the best-selling thing I ever write. And so that, but I was kind of taking my own work down because I'm like, oh, this isn't peer reviewed. It's, you know, it's not a real thing. And I shouldn't do that. And no one should do that to themselves or to anyone else. It's a real output. It took a lot of real research to do and real work. And yet I have so internalized still, and I'm trying to get it out of me kind of a thing, but I've so internalized that it wasn't real work because it wasn't heavy academic publishing in a top journal kind of a thing. And we're taught that to the point where I also feel that way about certain journal articles I've actually had published, where I'm like, oh, but you know, the journal doesn't have the highest, whatever that rate number is about how many people click on it and things. And so we so internalize. So it's not even about imposter syndromes. It's more just about that unless you do the very tip-top thing, you're never going to get there. You're never going to arrive. Mm-hmm. And that's so damaging. So in some ways, I kind of got off that roller coaster. But in other ways, I'm still very mentally on it because it is so hard to leave. But in other respects, I feel like I've actually really stopped feeling the need to produce. But that also took a long time to get to. So the ability to say, you know what, it's 6 p.m. I've been working since about 9:30 a.m. That's fine. Like, that's good for today. We don't need to push it that much more. No, you don't need to get up at 5 to finish that thing. You said you'd turn it in today. I'm sure they'll take it a day late, sort of a thing. And that's one of those dirty secrets of academia they don't tell you, just like that it's okay to skip a conference panel every now and again. It is also okay to ask for an extension on a deadline. Like, that is fine. And that a lot of professors, very, very august, renowned people, totally blow through deadlines and are months late on writing projects. And we never hear that part of it. But now that I'm on the other side of getting to be an editor and working with journals more, I know precisely how late certain people are on things. And it's phenomenal how you can be years late on a project. And we never talk about that as graduate students or as kind of young academics, that a lot of senior academics don't feel that push to produce because they're able to push around a bit more with those, the ways in which outputs are supposed to be delivered. And that actually younger academics can do the same thing.
The thing that I really want to know kind of the most is what has surprised you the most about your work?
What has surprised me? In general, and specifically with maps, my job is so cool because literally every day I'm working with, this week I did a map in Armenian that was from a guy who was publishing an Armenian encyclopedia. And he did this map kind of as a propaganda piece about his self-published on his own printing press encyclopedia. And that was from the 1960s. And thankfully I have a friend who speaks Armenian and she helped me out. And then I've also was working on a 15th century map that we have that's a world map that doesn't look anything like the world we have now. And so just every single day I get to work with something totally different, which is very challenging because I am trained as primarily as a European specialist and a Pacific specialist. But at the same time, really, really fun to get to dig into African liberation movements one day and then kind of Chinese printing practices in the 10th century the next day. So I like how varied it is in terms of the research I get to do and the scholars I get to interact with, because I don't know all this stuff, so I have to reach out for lots and lots of help. And then beyond that, how, I guess what surprised me in terms of having a job that's academic adjacent is that I get to be a whole person, and I get to have kind of this whole other life and be kind of a much fuller person than I felt like I had been while I was focusing only on running the race to be the academic in the university. And so I felt like I've been able to do a lot of growth that was probably very necessary for a very long time, but that I didn't get the opportunity to do. And so I'm surprised at how fun it actually has been, I guess, to get to know myself again, which has been really fulfilling. And thankfully, my husband is very forgiving and patient as I discover myself.
I don't know what your partner does, and I don't want to intrude, but I feel like it does take a certain type of person to put up with, or to, you know, not necessarily put up, but to like to understand or empathize or you know, somehow make peace with the I want to say like the constant chatter,
yep,
that academics kind of have. Like I feel like I'm always talking either, mm-hmm, like to myself in my head, and that's like quite quiet, but sometimes I'll like be talking out something out loud, and I'll be like, well, you know, I read this book and I really like it, and it does what it says it does, but this whole body of literature is flawed because, mm-hmm, of something, and I'll be like, but I don't know if I want to put that in a review, and
right,
and that will be like my conversation to myself, and I'll just be thinking out loud, and then my partner will be like, well, I mean, is it true? And I'll, yes. And he'll say, well, then you should say it. But I do think it takes like a certain type of, I don't know, like grace, like the amount of grace that partners of academics or partners of people who've been in the academy must.
No, absolutely. And he's actually a researcher as well, but he specializes in law. So I think our only saving grace is that he is not in my field. And so that we can help each other and listen to each other. And our favorite thing to do is be like, today I'm doing this, and run through all the things we're supposed to be doing in terms of projects and things. But that because we're not actually in the same field, we also sometimes can just nod while the other person's going off about something.
Yes.
And just be like, uh-huh. Oh, sure. That sounds great. That sounds fine. And so, because the other person just needs to talk it out. They in no way actually expect the other person to substantially contribute to this conversation.
And so I think very important.
Very important. Yeah. Marriage is based on nods is what it is. And so that has been helpful. And yeah, I just appreciate my husband also kind of, because I also work, even before all this, I worked primarily from home.
Mm-hmm.
And I often work on the couch. So I think a lot of things that, like, I think most of the time he thinks I'm just napping, but I am reading or doing some sort of productive thing. But also I think there's a lot of, and he does understand this, there's a lot of just thinking. I you know, I sit and stare into space a lot, and it's not because I'm not doing anything. It's because I'm trying to process or figure out how I want to write something or say something in a coherent way. And I think that's a lot of the part of academic work, whether or not you're actually in a university position or not, that thinking actually demands time and space. And I am super lucky in my job right now that I have that time and space. And I feel like I've only gotten more of that time and space now that COVID has hit. And that's very lucky. Yeah, go for it.
I think, you know, I didn't really think too much about learning styles until recently. And I, what I mean, what
no,
I mean,
fair.
To say,
yeah.
My partner and I are both in grad school right now. He's going for his master's in library science, and I'm going for a master's in nonprofit administration. Mm-hmm. So we're doing different things. Sometimes they overlap a little bit, but it's been really interesting for us both doing schoolwork from home and sort of watching his learning style and kind of evaluating how different it is from mine. Really interesting to just kind of watch different learning styles and see how, I guess, different disciplines, but also just different people.
Yeah. One of my favorite things to talk about with people is like their writing process. Like, how do you write? Because I am a huge outliner. Like, I have to outline and put in actual quotes. And so basically my footnotes are already done before I even start, because I've already got that all figured out. And I have all my little, like, the hooks and the then the argument goes here and then it does this. And so my outlines are usually half the word count of the actual document that it's going to be.
Absolutely.
And so that takes a good, usually 2 weeks of me just kind of reviewing sources and doing that. And it's only when I have that full outline that I can actually sit down. And then it's the very intensive hours. I can only get about 4 good writing hours a day, really 4 to 5. And then I'm mush. But those, it takes a huge amount of planning before I can even think of starting to write something. And very often I think I'm ready to write and I sit down and then I'm like, nope, actually not there yet. Need to do some more planning kind of a thing. Whereas other people, yeah, just sit down and they figure it out as they're drafting, which is bizarre to me. So I love talking to people about their writing and that they have to have like certain kinds of tea, or some people are like, oh yeah, I love to have a glass of wine while I'm writing. And I'm like, what? And so I love hearing about how people write. It super, super interests me. I was a writing instructor while I was in undergrad and graduate school. So it's something I just absolutely love it. It interests me so much.
Yeah. For me, I have to start with the introduction. I have to write, you know, this, even if it's not a full introduction, sometimes it's just a sentence and this is my argument. And then each part of that gets a bullet point. And I kind of build from there. It'll be a topic sentence and then all of my sources quotes. And then the next topic sentence, all of those sources and quotes. And then only at the end do I actually string it all together.
Realize what you were doing. Yeah. No, absolutely. I'm so, yeah. And whereas, yeah, my partner totally writes in a very different way that I don't understand. But it's, yeah, it absolutely fascinates me how people do this. Like, what?
I was living with someone, you know, one of my roommates was in like the final dissertation, you know, stages. And that was the year that I took my exam. So we were both kind of like, we would be up at weird hours. And, you know, one day she saw me. Or one day I saw her just like typing furiously and I was like, and you know, I just kind of like left her alone because I didn't want to interrupt that. And then like later, you know, like later that day or later that week, I was like, so do you just write all of your stuff on your computer? You just type? And she was like, yeah, you don't? And I was like, no, everything is written out by hand.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Everything has to, for me to make it coherent, it has to be written out by hand.
Oh, I've never done that. I've always done computer drafting. Ooh.
See, that's, I did handwritten through undergraduate and through my master's in history. But then every so often I would type it up, print it, and go through with the edits. And I would add like substantial amounts, but I couldn't think it through the first time around. I had to wait until the second read. I had a very long, involved process. I've gotten better with, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect. It has to be done.
Yep.
But I used to struggle.
Oh yeah. No, for sure. For sure.
The first time I write anything, it starts on like a notepad. Sometimes if I'm, you know, if I'm just going from a primary source and I'm just like rolling with the sources, then I can just use my computer and go, go, go. But if I'm doing like weird theory things, or I'm trying to figure out how to introduce the source, or it has to be by hand, otherwise it just reads like weird sentence salad.
Right. And that is actually one of the really liberating things about the map thing. So when I'm doing a map description, we call them, but there's also analysis in them, those I really can just, depending on them, kind of research for about an hour, hour and a half, and then write them up real quick. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I can do that with maps endlessly, even to the point where some of these are 4,000 word descriptions and they're kind of involved. Whereas if it's my research, it's just like, could never possibly do that of just kind of reading something and then being like, okay, let's do this. And I think part of it has to do is we don't footnote on our website. We have a reference section, but I don't have to directly footnote in terms of, you know, in that really proper academic style. And that is freeing in some ways. But it also makes me always nervous because I'm like, what if people wonder where I got this? Like, how will they know? But of course, that's only an academic would worry about that, because normal readers don't really have that problem.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people are willing to just like take something on faith. You know, like, oh, I read it, it must be true. And I love how trusting people can be, but it also creates a lot of like myths about topics or about people. Or I'm sure you've seen this in maps. And
oh, absolutely. We have some big ones about like the Zeno map is a big myth, and you either believe in it or you don't.
Okay, so what is the Zeno
map? It's a map about early that supposedly shows pre-Columbian and like early Viking contact with North America, but it's from a very flawed source of this kind of fantastical Italian travel account sort of a situation. When they go to kind of, it's very Gulliver's Travels-y in terms of the place names and things like that. But, and there's also the Vinland map, which is supposed to be a Viking map that shows North America, like in, you know, around the year 1000 or something. Other people who listen to this are going to be like, you're wrong, those details are terrible, but that's a rough approximation about what they are. And those kind of go back and forth endlessly in the map world. We have those bugbears for sure. And we do, thankfully, I'm much a stickler for citation. So we do have hefty reference sections on all of our map descriptions. But I think not having to worry sentence by sentence. I mean, if there's a direct quote, I would say where that came from. But not having to worry sentence by sentence about like, well, and this idea sort of came from here, but this part came from there. And then if you want to read more, do this. So to not have to do that at a sentence level every moment is freeing in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Or to figure out a way to introduce to your reader, well, okay, so this part of the sentence I got in this archive and the rest of the sentence I got from that archive. But the sentence preceding it is just from the secondary literature.
Right. And yet, just because I'm so quoting them doesn't mean there isn't original thought in there, too. Like from
exactly.
Me.
Yeah. Exactly. Just, you know, being, I guess, like, not being forced to separate it all out. Instead, do, like, a very kind of, like, cohesive, holistic analysis of what this map is and what it means. That sounds very freeing.
It is. And yet I've also, at the same time, the other side of that coin is I've really struggled with the proper tone for these map descriptions, because we want them to sound scholarly and researched, because they are very much so. But at the same time, they need to be accessible to a non-scholastic audience. And writing for that audience has been quite a transition for me, because I only ever did write for the academic audience. So that's been a fun but very challenging road for me. And then we also have an internship program. And so then getting to work with the students on their writing and how they would write about the map and approach it as an object to be analyzed has been really fulfilling, but also, again, very challenging to kind of take on a bit of that mentor role and try and move them towards a goal without doing it for them.
Mm-hmm. It is challenging sometimes to say, okay, well, here's the map. Here, or, you know, here's the object. Here's how I've done it in the past. And, you know, I'm here for you, but you're in the driver's seat here. I'm just here to tell you what, you know, if you ask, I'm here to give you a direction, but that's it.
Right. And then it's always fine until they think they've done it. And then they send it to you. You're like, oh, okay. So it is much like teaching. And that you'd come back that way. But that internship is entirely digital as well. So doing that over mostly email or Skype is challenging. But I feel like I live a very digitally international life anyway at this point, but even before COVID. So that is all getting much easier. And now everyone has to do it, so it's fine.
Yes, now we all have to do it, and we all have to work out our process for doing these digital things and making sure that we're understood without being, like, one time someone said something to me and I just responded instinctively, and I realized that if we were speaking, you know, if we were like face to face, I wouldn't have given such a strong response.
Exactly. Yeah,
I would have just like laughed or like rolled my eyes, but I was like, oh, I didn't realize you had so much going on. And then he got like my agenda for the week. And I was like, tell me I'm not busy now.
Yeah, it's like, yeah.
Okay.
And he was like, I was just remarking how busy you were. It's fine. I was like, oh, okay, sorry, ma'am.
Yeah, well, okay, stepping back.
Didn't mean to go that hard.
But it is very hard in working with students, either in a classroom setting and now a digital classroom setting, or with our interns, when I'm editing, I find that I have very different voice in terms of because I've done a lot of writing coaching, so I'm very good at composing myself in that, talking about the overall document. But in terms of sentence level stuff, I feel like when I track changes, I'm very direct. And then I'm just like, wrong. Like, don't do that. And so then it's hard. Sometimes I have to go back and make sure or reassure the student ahead of time that I'm like, I'm not saying that you did a terrible job. It's just I really want to model for you, because we're not having an in-person interaction like this one. I'm going to really model for you how it's going to be that way you can apply it to the next one. But there's no good way. It's kind of like text. Sometimes it's not a subtle way of communication. It's not nuanced. And I feel like track changes is also not very nuanced in terms of communication.
It's not nuanced, and it feels like it's a just brute force kind of correction.
Absolutely, yeah. And I don't haven't quite cracked how to make that nicer, but when I do, I'll let you know.
The Google suite has a nice little one because it's like so and so is suggesting.
Oh yeah, they use all this kind of kinder language.
That because I would just much rather see what I'm used to in Microsoft with the track changes.
Right.
And be like, oh, okay, so that sentence actually belonged there. This makes sense. You're right, this footnote is empty. Okay, cool, I'll fix this. I'll get it back to you in a couple weeks. But
I also love the Google Suite, though, because they have, like, anonymous rhinoceros, or everyone has funny animals. They make me so happy.
Oh, my goodness.
Anonymous hedgehog, I think, is my favorite one.
It makes writing things in committee so much better.
It is, except I love... That's a fun working from home thing, because my husband will just hear him being like, who's the anonymous panda? Like, who is that? And you're just like, okay.
So what are you currently reading, or what are you doing for fun right now?
For fun? I was like, for work, I'm definitely reading Ricardo Padrón's latest book, The Indies of the Setting Sun, which is about Spanish, very early modern perceptions of the Pacific as an extension mostly of their holdings in the Americas. That I've been waiting for years for it to come out, and I'm so excited. But then for fun, I am about halfway through The 10,000 Doors of January right now by Alex E. Harrow, who is actually also an ex-academic. And it is phenomenal, kind of very fun fantasy, but her training as a historian is also very clear. And that is really, really good. And then I also just read actually a book by a friend, which is kind of a first for me. But my friend, Nairi Bakalian, she just published one called Grey Dawn. Mm-hmm. That is a time traveling Civil War story. And it is super well detailed. If you have ever been to Philadelphia, that's where it is set. And she has so much love for Philadelphia as a place. It's wonderfully evocative, and it's a wonderful, wonderful lesbian love story woven into it, and it's so cute.
I have to read it.
Yeah, oh, it's so good. It's amazing, and there's going to be more, so it's like the first in a series, so I can't wait till she writes more of them. So I've been kind of dabbling more in the historical fantasy genre lately, I guess. And then I'm rereading, just because I love it, Prairie Fires, which is a biography of Laurie Ingalls Wilder.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, because I loved Little House on the Prairie when I was little, problematic as it is, and I'm very aware of that. But it's Carolyn Fraser wrote it, and it's phenomenal. She won all sorts of awards when it came out like 2 years ago, but it's totally worth reading. Although it'll kind of ruin certain things for the books for you, so you'll be like, oh no.
So one of the things that I really liked about those books was that Laura Ingalls Wilder, her sister Carrie was disabled, and
Mary, I think the older one, because
Carrie was blind.
No, that's Mary because she gets typhoid.
I don't know why I thought it was Carrie. Whatever.
Carrie's the younger one.
Oh, okay.
Baby Carrie, and then there's Grace at the very end. Yeah.
Okay, so see that's why we need to have these conversations.
Yeah, that's right. But yeah, because Mary gets typhoid in the fourth one. I don't know why I still know all this. Like, this is taking up so much space in my mind. Why is it there? Like, why?
It's making me better. Oh my goodness. So you know, her sister is blind, and it's like a very, from what I remember, it was like a very humanizing portrayal of a disabled girl.
Mm-hmm. Like, and then she goes to, they save up money, and she goes to the school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it wasn't like this sad, terrible story. She's never going to amount to anything in life, or it wasn't, you know, like she became disabled because of illness, but I don't remember it being so terrible that her sister became disabled. It was just like
absolutely. And then Mary always has like these pretty funny, like wisecracking lines after that. She stays pretty witty afterwards.
Yeah.
I've loved, and then the portrayal of a very realistic love story, actually, I appreciated as a child, like when she meets Almanzo and they have just a terrible first 4 years. Like, the first 4 years is actually really rough as a book. Like, they don't do well, and I'm pretty sure she has a miscarriage, and she writes about that as well. And so that, as a child, it's still written for kids for sure, but having that kind of more realistic portrayal, and of course it's still very partial, and there's issues with definitely that they were squatting on Native American land and things like that. But it was, as a young baby historian who always has loved history, I love those books so much, and they really taught me a lot, actually.
One of the things that I wanted to do with my advisor is I wanted the two of us to teach a class. So, like, I would probably end up being her TA for it, you know, if this had ever happened. This would be, like, mm-hmm. my dream class to teach, where the two of us would just systematically ruin Little House on the Prairie.
Yes! Oh, I would totally, I would take that class, I would teach that class, heck yes, that'd be great.
And because, you know, a lot of, like, her relationship with Almanzo is she's so disappointed that he's not her father. That he's right. not, like, the same kind of, like, rugged, frontier, masculine man that her father was. And she never wanted to marry a farmer boy, ever.
Right. And then, like, and then, yeah, she definitely settles the whole time, and it's really disappointing.
Her mother settled, like.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And then her love for Pa is also so flawed. Because Pa's a failure. He tries and fails, like, 8 different, like, businesses and things.
Oh, my
gosh.
And
he's kind of a hustler. Like, and when things don't work, he's like, all right, family, let's go.
Yeah, he's like, I don't know why they left Wisconsin, but they leave Wisconsin, right? Like, they almost die crossing the river. Their dog disappears. That was terrible.
That was terrible. I forgot about that till now. Oh.
Yeah. Jack came back, and, you know, like.
Jack does come back, yeah. I'm not sure so, Jack did that in real life.
I mean, I hope he did, but whatever. It was not a sad dog story, which I did appreciate.
No, and in her real life, between Wisconsin and actually Indian Territory, and then between Indian Territory and the banks of Plum Creek, they actually end up in, like, Iowa in a town somewhere, and he has 2 or 3 other failed things in there that she just decides not to write about.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, so there's all this extra. And then there's a brother, too. They do have a brother at one point, but he dies quite young.
I don't know if that was in the book. That might have been in the book.
I'm not sure. I know Ma has another baby, but I think it's baby Grace. I think it's the girl.
I'm going to have to reread these now.
I know, right? And then, yeah, but read them with Prairie Fires by Carolyn Fraser. Total thumbs up on that book. It's phenomenal.
Definitely. Oh, I'm so excited we got to talk today.
This has been wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this has been so much fun.
Yeah, like I said, good luck editing it. I'm not sure it's going to be coherent at all.
It'll be totally fine. I promise. It'll work. So if you could give one piece of advice to your younger self, what do you think it would be?
Probably settle down. But that's also the advice everyone gave me, and I didn't listen to it. So,
settle down or calm the F down?
Both. Yeah. Just okay. Like stop being frenetic and, like, you're worrying about everything all the time. But I was given that advice at the time and I did not listen to it. So that wouldn't be very effective, I guess. But I think I just pat myself on the back and say, like, it will be all right. If I, in this scenario, I would want to know that it was me giving this advice, like, future self. But yeah, just to, because I was always, you know, as not even a graduate student, even just as a universal human thing, you're so anxious to make sure you're not messing up this one life kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And so you end up missing a lot of fun things or good things because you're trying so hard for this undefined future. So just, like, I tell myself that it will be okay. And also, it won't be anything like you think it is, because there are fire tornadoes and COVID and the entire year of 2020 coming up that you're just not ready for.
It's like that one comedian who keeps doing the 3 month later videos where she, like, her current self visits her former self. And she's just like, have you heard about the murder hornets yet? And this girl is just so traumatized. Like, what do you mean? What's coming?
Oh, yeah. Or it's, yeah, like that scene in Ant-Man 2, I think it is. It's in the Avengers when he wakes up or comes back from the nether regions or whatever the small world is. And his friend's like, oh, yeah, and then this happened and then that happened. Like, all the things. And you're like, oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh. I had a thought and I totally lost it. Oh, Jen Kirkman, who's a comedian who I love, and she's totally problematic. I guess I'll figure this out on my own. But she is doing, like, weekly, like, meditation things and, like, deep breathing things for her fans.
Ooh.
Which is just, like, lovely. She has a big, like, anxiety binder she sent out to everyone. Like, everyone on her mailing list.
Oh.
I'm like, wow, Jen Kirkman, so wholesome. She also had a thing about, she did it on her Facebook where she was, like, doing a one-woman movie, like, from, like, Boston or Massachusetts, and co-starred, like, Ben Affleck, where she leaves her boyfriend because he's, like, he's being, like, a big baby All Lives Matter person. And,
oh.
And, yeah, so she does that. And yeah. And she's like totally calling him, you know, calling him like a big baby. And like, this isn't about you. Like, why can't you realize that there are bigger problems in this country? Not everything revolves around you. And like, and then at the end, she's like, what? What? Like, you think your brothers who are cops are like big men? What are they going to do? Arrest a crawler? And I just so appreciate it. Like, I appreciate comedy.
So. It's comedy has been helpful. And I've definitely been self-soothing with like sitcoms and just watching far too much of them and then making them very problematic. We zoomed through The Big Bang Theory as a rewatch, and much as I love it, there are so many problems.
that's pretty rich with problems. Did you watch, I found it very soothing when I watched it, Lucifer? Has been very, it's not a comedy, it's like a drama, but
I think Netflix suggests it to me, so we could watch it.
It's lovely. I recommend it.
Oh, the best thing we watched in lockdown, for sure, was Money Heist. Well, not, my husband says West Wing, but that's a given. West Wing's a constant. But the Money Heist it's originally a Spanish show, and it is about stealing money from the Spanish government twice. Printing money. And it's just, like, it sounds kind of weird, but I watch it. So good. It's so good.
So we will. And while we are watching and scrolling, if our listeners want to learn more about your work or what you do, where can they find you online?
Probably the easiest is on Twitter. So at KatieParker18. And that is where I do all my professional Twitter story and tweeting.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming and chatting with us. We've had just so much fun and we've learned so many things.
Thank you. I've had a great time as well and learned from you guys for sure.
This has been such a fun afternoon. We've got some amazing episodes lined up for you guys over the next few months. We're planning to talk to scholars from all different fields and backgrounds.
If you are a scholar beyond the tower with a story to share, please email us at scholarsbeyondthetower@gmail.com. or DM us on our social media.
We've purposely kept our mission pretty broad because we want to be able to talk about how we engage with our work and with the public inside, outside, and adjacent to the Ivory Tower.
You can find us on Twitter at Beyond Tower, on Instagram at Scholars Beyond the Tower, and on Facebook as Scholars Beyond the Tower.
You can find me on Twitter at @ErinE_Becker.
You can find me on Twitter at Caroline C. Progro.
You can find Scholars Beyond the Tower wherever you get your podcasts. Please rate, review, and subscribe so we can reach a wider audience.
Well, scholars, until next time,
stay connected and stay caffeinated.